I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Each week we take on an important single issue, an issue that involves all of the human beings on this planet. And this one certainly is that case. It is, what is the SARS virus in its actuality? You've been told that, of course, we know what the SARS virus is. It evolved naturally, jumped species, and it's equated originally, especially from some of the people who were doing mathematical models of its potential lethality, to being like the Spanish flu back in 1918 that decimated tens of millions. We were told to quarantine. We must do it. In fact, it was against the law not to. Do you remember the photograph of the man alone on a beach in California being arrested? The woman sitting virtually alone in a stadium, cheering her son who was playing, I believe it was soccer, and she was tasered for not having a mask. Do you remember all the admonitions that we had about how we were not going to help anyone if we didn't follow the rules? And I started to think, all right, how many of these rules are based upon really good qualified science? How many of them are tried and true? How many are based upon empirical data? After all, we've had a lot of doctors, more than 800,000 physicians, more or less, in the United States. Many are frontline physicians, so shouldn't we be bringing them into the discussion? But we didn't. In fact, almost all of our original planning came from individuals who, as well-intentioned as they may be, and I'm not questioning their intention, were wrong by substantial measure. But that didn't change anything. Everyone was go ahead anyhow. So for the physicians who had treatments using antiretroviral FDA-approved drugs, we were told, don't use them. In fact, we were specifically told there's nothing you really can do. Stay home, stay protected until such time that you're too sick for anything else and then go into a hospital. So the sense of lethality, the total devastation of this scared a lot of people. We were told a lot of facts to believe. Don't question them. And if you did question them, then something was wrong with you. No matter what your reputation, no matter what your background, when Luc Montagnier, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering the HIV virus at the Institute of Pasteur, he and colleagues found that there was something wrong with this virus. It had an HIV element to it. And another group found a cobra venom. And another group found prions. And so we began to question, well, how would these get into this virus? Well, nobody knew exactly, but don't question it. Everyone is equally vulnerable. Therefore, everyone should get the vaccine. Gabby, Bill Melinda Gates Foundation, Anthony Fauci, World Health Organization, National Institutes of Health, all over the world, people were saying, wait for the vaccine or a particular new drug, antiretroviral drug. And we waited. And we waited. So to this day, when we turn around and do an honest look, how many of the things were we told with certainty by people who were absolutely convincing in their argument were either partially true or completely false? To answer this, we are bringing to you from Texas, Dr. Richard Fleming, F-L-E-M-I-N-G. He is a board-certified cardiologist specializing in nuclear medicine who has shown a direct correlation between inflammation and heart disease. He holds a Ph.D. also in particle physics, graduated from the University of Iowa College of Medicine, and later completed a law degree. His research has revealed the intrinsic errors in the methods currently in use to detect heart disease and breast cancer. He is the inventor of the Fleming method for tissue and vascular differentiation and metabolism, a method that quantifies tissue activity due to inflammation and infection. In the past, he has taught at the University of Texas and conducted cardiological research at Methodist College and Creighton University. He is also putting his attention on uncovering the health risks from both the SARS-2 virus and the COVID vaccines. But he's not supposed to do that. No one is supposed to do that, because we were told with great fanfare and certainty, headlines in the New York Times, 95% effective is the vaccine. So people rushed out to get the test to determine, do you have COVID? Reasonable enough, assuming that that test is accurate. And that's the PCR test. And people came back in droves, positive. That's a little odd, because the vast majority of these people, even younger people, athletic people, were positive, but they had no symptoms, the vast majority. Well, then the argument was asymptomatic people, meaning having no symptoms, are the primary spreaders, not just people who are sick in a hospital or at home, coughing and sneezing. And therefore, the justification of wearing masks, social distancing, all based upon, we were assured, absolutely current science. And therefore, make sure that if you are positive, now the New York Times said if you're positive, you are a case. That's strange, because I was of the belief that if you were positive, that didn't mean that you were necessarily sick. It might have been that you had previously had this or another coronavirus, and therefore your body had created natural immunity. And if you already have natural immunity and you're healthy and have no comorbidities, is there a problem then giving a vaccine? Oh, no. No, everybody's got to get the vaccine. So Richard Gale and myself began to do some additional research, and especially on immunity. And we were puzzled by the idea that surely all the great minds at the National Institutes of Health and Anthony Fauci's specific division, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, as well as those at the National Cancer Institute and the National Institute on Aging, all of these fall under the umbrella of the National Institutes of Health, they would know whether it was wise to give people with autoimmune conditions a vaccine that may impact their immune system. Not to worry. This is none of your business, we were told. The experts have figured it out. Follow the directions as applied. So people dutifully did. And as a result today, we have a lot that we should be holding these people accountable to and for. To do that, my guest is online now. His website is FlemingMethod.com. We welcome Dr. Richard Fleming to our program to take a look around and say, here's what we got right. Here's what we got partially right. Here's what we got fully wrong, and here are the consequences. Nice to have you with us, Dr. Fleming.
Nice to be here, Gary. How are you?
Good. I'm excellent. Please take your time. I gave you a long introduction because there were many different things that I would like for you to unpackage for us. So the forum is yours.
Well, thank you. SARS-CoV-2 and the subsequent disease, COVID-19, have certainly grabbed everybody's attention in a very unpleasant and previously undocumented approach. It has indeed been a pandemic in that it has affected everybody worldwide in one manner or another. I think the crux of all of this, however, lies within the origin of this particular virus. And it's important to point out that there's not a single person or agency that's responsible for this. This is the result of a number of people working over the better part of three decades, in some instances a little bit longer than that. There is a very nice paper trail that shows exactly who was involved, and that paper trail includes published research by scientists around the world, a lot of them in the United States and in China, but other places as well. There are patents that have actually been received and funded, many of them, by federal agencies of the United States. And there are multiple paper trails for research grants that have gone to several individuals whose names are becoming more and more well known to the general public. But it's fair to say that we can trace back the beginnings of this to 1999, when the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services began to be very interested in viruses and researching those. And a new concept really began to form on the lips of many individuals called gain of function. And gain of function is a method where scientists, including physicians, can work with, in this case, a virus to either increase the ability of the virus to infect people or to cause it to do more harm. And we know that there have been more than $61 million worth of federal grant monies coming from Health and Human Services, coming from the National Institutes of Health, USAID, Department of Commerce, Department of the Interior, the National Institutes of Allergies and Infectious Disease, and a variety of other federal agencies that have all gone to, many of them have gone to a Peter Daszak at EcoHealth, who subsequently gave money to Professor Ralph Barrick at the University of North Carolina, and to Shi Zhang Li of the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And they haven't been very quiet about the work that they've done. They've published multiple papers showing that they have worked with a variety of coronaviruses. And for people who have not yet heard how these viruses get their name, if we look at these viruses under an electron microscope, which is really what you need to do to see them because they're that small, you will see, if you slice them through the middle, you'll see a ring-like structure with little spikes sticking out. It's a sphere, but when you slice through it in a plane on a picture, it looks like a ring. And then you see the spikes standing out, and that makes it look like a crown. And that's how they got their term crown or coronaviruses. The first real coronaviruses that most people are familiar with date back to China in about 2002 when SARS-CoV or SARS coronavirus was first diagnosed as causing a significant reaction in the lungs of people. And that's where it gets the term SARS, because it produces inflammation and blood clotting in the lungs of individuals, making it very challenging for them to breathe. And Gary, you may remember having me on your program almost 2 decades ago, where we were talking about this inflammation and heart disease theory that I first presented at American Heart in 1994.
Yes.
And that particular research presentation I did had fallen on the heels of me being involved with a physician cholesterol education faculty dating back to 1976, where I said, this inflammatory process that we call coronary artery disease that causes people to have heart attacks and die is not just merely cholesterol, but there's a variety of factors in which I also explained that bacteria and viruses play a role in making these diseases worse. And we presented it in 94, and then I presented it again in 95, and it was published in a cardiology textbook in 1999. And then I did bacterial work from 2000 to 2003, and then in 2004, we're on 2020 talking about it. And I thought that it pretty much laid the foundation. So a lot of people have talked about inflammation and heart disease, and this explains all the other chronic inflammatory diseases like diabetes and high blood pressure and what I refer to as cerebrovascular disease, or what generally is referred to as strokes and cancers, and a variety of health problems that are the body undergoing this inflammation and blood clotting phenomenon. And that's a normal process to deal with a problem, but if the problem is a persistent one that's kind of driven by diet and lifestyles, then that sets a whole series of factors in place that make it impossible for the body to really recover. And if you have those scenarios going on and then you get a significant infection like SARS-CoV-2, but we also know that this is a problem with influenza and other viruses, that it can produce more inflammation and blood clotting that if you don't treat, and that's really kind of the key here, if you don't treat it, then you can die from it. And that's what we've seen, you know, hundreds of thousands and millions of people around the world not being treated for the inflammation and the blood clotting, which there's more than ample evidence, published research evidence showing a number of treatments that actually are successful in treating that. So we know that this disease process wasn't something that really needed to kill people, but it did because it wasn't treated. And this development did take several decades to really materialize SARS-CoV-2 in 2019. But its predecessor, SARS-CoV-1, was present in 2002, and contacts that I have in China have been very adamant in pointing out that SARS-CoV-1 itself was a man-made virus with the specific intention of increasing its ability to infect people and cause harm. And by definition, that means that it is a bioweapon because it's something man-made. It's not naturally occurring. And it has harm and injury to people. Gain of function in and of itself, however, is not a bad thing. Most science and it has some premise of good in it, but also the potential for nefarious problems that can occur. It's all a matter of whose hands it resides in, and the motives and the interests of those people. So the idea of gain of function is, if we could just stay ahead of these viruses or bacteria or a number of infectious diseases, but to simplify the discussion, we'll just stay with viruses right now. If we could just stay a step or two ahead of them, we would have a better idea of what mankind was going to face, and we could find treatments and or ways to prevent problems. The challenge is, however, when we jump ahead hundreds and thousands of years, evolutionary-wise, to changing these viruses in ways that they couldn't possibly manifest themselves. Now what you have is a situation where people really don't have the types of expected defenses, and clearly you're not trying to do it for the betterment of mankind, because the idea isn't to jump that far in the future. It's to stay one step ahead of it, not centuries ahead of it. And when you read the research papers of these people, it's very clear. It comes across in the writing, at least to me as a scientist, that they're delighted in what they've been able to accomplish, to take something that doesn't infect people and to make it infective in people. And you have to do more than one change to it to make that happen. When you're inserting HIV glycoprotein 120 into it, and you mentioned Luc Montagnier, Dr. Montagnier, brilliant gentleman. I've chatted with him a couple times now. As he's looked at this, he has, and he's a virologist. For your listeners, if they don't know, you did mention that he received the Nobel for discovering HIV. And as a point of comparison, HIV is the virus, AIDS is the disease, SARS-CoV-2 is the virus, COVID-19 is the disease. Cholesterol is a problem. Coronary artery disease is the disease. So not to confuse the disease and the virus, because there are a lot of people who think that COVID-19 is the name of the virus, and it's not. That's the disease. COVID means corona, C-O, virus, V-I, disease, D, first recognized in 2019. So Luc Montagnier has done a very outstanding job, as far as I'm concerned, of showing the differences in other coronaviruses and SARS-CoV-2, and pointing out the inserts that match both HIV and SIV, which is simian or ape immune deficiency viruses. Also included in there is the PRRA insert, and that's four letters. Each one of those letters stands for an amino acid. That's just how we do it in science. So the letter P stands for the amino acid proline, R for arginine, the second R for arginine, and the third A for alanine. And those are the four amino acids. And each amino acid is coded for by three nucleotide bases, and these are the things that make up the genetic sequences of DNA and RNA. So when you're looking at a PRRA insert, you're really looking at four amino acids and 12 nucleotides, and mutations occur one nucleotide at a time. So that's clearly not a naturally occurring process. And then Luc Montagnier has shown something like 1,770 nucleotide inserts that exist in SARS-CoV-2 that don't exist in any other coronavirus, including all the ones that they wanted to reference early on in this with pangolin and a variety of others. And these don't happen naturally. These are inserts. There's no way you can dance around this. You can try it, but I think that we've seen that they, as more information and those of us that are talking about this are getting out there and being heard more and more, the story is being changed from this is a naturally occurring zoonotic, which was driven by Peter Daszak of EcoHealth, who was the American who led the investigation of the Wuhan Institute of Virology lab. So it's kind of like sending the fox into the chicken coop. You know, the guy who's getting the money to help develop this is going over to see if it was developed there. And of course, the answer came back, no, it's naturally occurring. So the storyline has changed from it's naturally occurring to, well, it looks like it's potentially a lab leak, but we had nothing to do with it, right? And obviously, the more people think about it, the more I think it's obvious to just about everybody listening to it that this is something that not only was developed in the lab, but was intentionally, I think it's the sad recognition here, listening to the Chinese colleagues, that people that I've spoken with, and I call them colleagues because, you know, the problem here is not the American people. It's the American government that funded it. The problem here is not the Chinese people. It's the Chinese government that helped develop it. And what you have is the Americans playing the Chinese and the Chinese playing the Americans. And we all got caught in the middle of that. And the release of SARS-CoV-2, I think we're going to see as they continue to retreat in their efforts to best defend themselves, to not be held accountable and to point the fingers now at other people, we're going to see more and more recognition that this was intentionally released at the wet market by the Chinese to see what it would do. And it did exactly what it was designed to do. It spread from person to person. And you know, I think that the term bioweapon is not well understood, because I think most people look at a weapon and they say, well, that's meant to kill. And weapons aren't designed to kill. They do kill, but weapons are designed to be used to defeat your enemy. You don't have to kill your enemy. You just have to demoralize and destroy what they are, and you've essentially won. And the goal of releasing something not designed to kill, but to shut down societies and devastate their economies and stop people from communicating back and forth and allow governments to take unprecedented steps in controlling its people. And that included, you know, the United States. That recognition is becoming more and more pronounced. You know, Goering, when he was being tried at in 1947 at Nuremberg in the Nuremberg trials, blatantly told American prosecutors that any people will follow the directions and directives of the government if the government establishes enough fear and concern and threat. And we've seen that with 9/11. We've seen that with SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19, if you want to think of the disease. We have seen this repeatedly and been rather slow to learn from it. In that people will surrender their freedoms with the perception that they are somehow obtaining security. One of the components of the title of Event 2021 that we did here in Dallas on the 5th of June, just a couple weeks ago, was what if the people you trust are the people causing the problem? And unfortunately, you know, I wasn't looking for something like SARS-CoV-2 to validate the theory that I first presented in 94. But that's the best thing I can say out of it is that it validates the theory. But, you know, sometimes devastating things have to happen for people to recognize that there's a problem. And I think what has happened is there's been enough devastation from this infectious virus and the disease that's not been treated that it's resulted in people asking questions that I don't think the governments really thought would be asked of them. And what you see every time is a doubling down of the efforts. I knew when Redfield made his announcement that there would be immediate pushback to him, that when he said, you know, look, he doesn't work at the CDC anymore, but he's a virologist, and in his opinion, this is a lab agent, you know. And the first thing you saw was Anthony Fauci and everybody else getting on the news media program saying Redfield doesn't know what he's talking about. And then the next thing that happened was, well, maybe there's some viral component, but we didn't do it, you know. And that's where we're at right now. But we have enough data that we've already shared. I've shared in presentations, and we're sharing soon in a book that will be coming out, laying out the details of these papers, this paper trail of research showing that Barrick and Daszak and Zhang Li and others have intentionally manipulated these viruses, shown that they could make them infective. I mean, it's not so much as, you know, just some of the simple stuff that you hear where people have said, well, they took the backbone of one virus and the spike protein of another and put them together. And, you know, that in itself would be huge gain of function. And it's referred to as chimeric because a chimer is a combination of more than one type of living organism and combined together, back to Greek mythology or, you know, the griffin, or in modern terms, Frankenstein, all the different parts from different people. But they went further than that, where they actually put five specific nucleotides into this virus, one of which was in the envelope structural protein area, which is critical for a brain infection. That envelope, as well as the spike protein, are critical to getting into the brain and causing brain damage, specifically prion-like diseases that hopefully we'll get into a bit later on. But, you know, these pieces of evidence show an intentional, knowing development of a bioweapon that violates the Biological Weapons Convention Treaty. It violates the Helsinki Codes for treatment of patients. It violates the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights Treaty. It violates, and the use of these bioweapons without informed consent, violates the Code of Ethics of the American Medical Association. There are so many criminal laws. I mean, in truth, the Americans that were involved in this because of the impact on this country, in addition to being guilty of perjury by sitting under testimony and denying gain-of-function monies have gone out, given the information, the evidence that we have. They are guilty of treason from all this.
I believe there will be. Good. I appreciate that overview. I'm going to ask you two types of questions and then sit back with the audience. The first will be if you could give us the short answer on the following. This is all pre what most of the people out there were aware of. Now we're into the post part where we have the vaccines. Now we're seeing a very large spike in deaths and injuries, more so right now than all American vaccines combined over the last 30 years. And yet, instead of having a moment of pause, the precautionary principle, Anthony Fauci and all the major media and all the government agency and Bill Gates are saying more, faster, now. So they think that it's a great thing that they're giving hundreds of millions of vaccines around the world without questioning who should get them or their people who shouldn't. If you look at the major media, everybody should get the vaccine, including those who already have natural immunity because they've had COVID, which is a large percentage, as much as 30% of Americans have had COVID with minimal, or different types of symptoms. And also, what about the 130 million Americans who have some form of autoimmune condition, rheumatoid arthritis, heart transplant recipients, or any organ transplant, or those with lupus, et cetera? Then we have the idea, they said the vaccine would stay in the deltoid muscle in the shoulder. Not true. They said it couldn't shed. Not true. They said it couldn't get into the bloodstream. Not true. They said it couldn't be the reason for all these blood clots and encephalopathic conditions, the brain. Not true. So I'd like for you to address what you see is happening in the bodies, because we spent the time to look at every one of the deaths spiking within 24 hours after receiving this in young people, and they put it under unknown causes, but exceptional to heart disease and the normal causes of death. So suddenly, when you take into account all the normal reasons people die, and you're left with this huge number, over 25,000 people in America, and you just simply say, well, they don't fit anywhere, so we don't know, and yet they happen on frequently on the same day as the vaccine, then that is telling. And lastly, I'd like for you to begin, however, by telling us about the PCR test that they told us was an absolute gold standard, that if you were a case, if you tested positive, you were a case. That's the New York Times, this many cases, without distinguishing the difference between HIV COVID positive versus a case, that don't do anything. Don't try ivermectin. Don't try hydroxychloroquine. Don't try azithromycin or zinc. Don't try anything, because nothing is going to be approved. Wait for the drug. And yet thousands of doctors were treating a great many patients successfully using these inexpensive off-patent drugs. And so they said don't. They even did a frontal attack in Lancet and the British Medical, the New England Journal of Medicine, condemning hydroxychloroquine. It turned out it was all false, and both those articles were retracted. But their argument not to use them was not retracted. Any doctors, scientists who were saying these were positive, their reputations were trashed. They were canceled and destroyed.
Yeah.
So that's the backdrop. Also, they gave us figures without distinguishing how many of the people died originally in the first 5 or 6 months were already at death's door with comorbidities, 2.6 comorbidities, and had lived their normal lifespan. And they clumped them all together. As if, this is how many people are dying, and it freaked everyone out. So those are two separate issues, pre the vaccines, the lies that were told, and post-vaccines, the lies that are being told.
Okay, so there's a lot to unpack there, and hopefully I'll remember all the different components. I'm probably going to answer something different than what you expect, and that the deaths that are tallied up for COVID that are associated with heart attacks and all that other stuff, these really are COVID deaths. They are COVID deaths. And here's what people need to understand. And so I'm going to do a brief comparison between getting the infection and the vaccines. The reason why it's accurate that these are COVID deaths is because, as I explained in the 94 theory, if you get an infection, and particularly if you have these comorbidities, you're going to have an inflammothrombotic response. They did die because they got infected with SARS-CoV-2 and developed COVID. But they died because they didn't get treated. So the deaths of all of these people, while I would argue they are accurate to be counted, are on the hands of the people that developed this virus and then prevented doctors from treating patients. That makes this even more nefarious. Okay. The reason why we're seeing the consequences from the vaccines is because when you get a virus from person to person, you maybe get hundreds or thousands of the viruses, particles. And every one of those viruses carries a mRNA, one mRNA to insert into your cells through a series of receptors, key sites, beginning with the ACE2 receptor. So 500 or 1,000 or 2,000 or 5,000, they all have to find an ACE2 receptor. They download one mRNA into your cell and the process begins. So who's vulnerable? The people that have the inflammatory thrombotic diseases who aren't being treated. And that's what we saw die. All right. The problem with the vaccines and why we're seeing problems in healthy individuals that have never had a problem before is because the vaccines, the Pfizer and the Moderna that has lipid nanoparticles, they don't require an ACE2 receptor to get in. They just merge with the cells and dump the vaccine in. But here's the thing. Instead of hundreds or thousands, the Pfizer and Moderna lipid nanoparticle vaccines carry 13.1 billion mRNAs. The AstraZeneca, the adenovirus double-stranded DNA carries 50 billion double-stranded DNAs. So hundreds and thousands versus billions being dumped into people's cells. So healthy people, young people, are making an immune response not to a normal amount of a virus, but to a massive overload of a virus. And if their immune systems are working, and they are, they will make a massive response. And that's why you're seeing all of these reactions in people who haven't had problems. Couple that in the poor people who have immune diseases. And that's just dropping a match on gasoline. You know, so that's why we're seeing with these vaccines all the problem. Remember back to swine flu? We lost 25 people and they pulled the plug. We're at thousands of deaths following these vaccines. No hesitancy at all on stopping this experiment that's going on where you're either in the experimental or the control group. That being said is kind of the preface. Let's go back to the question you asked me to address first, which is the PCR test. Now, you had Kerry Mullis. I've seen the interviews you've done. And I think we all are aware that Kerry Mullis died from a pneumonia in 2019 with no prior health problems. He just suddenly dies from a pneumonia. Kerry Mullis was the last person who took on Anthony Fauci. Kerry Mullis patented a brilliantly designed test called the polymerase chain reaction, or PCR test, that is designed to look for genetic sequences. And if you go read the patent that Dr. Mullis developed, it says to stop cycling at 20 cycles. You know, so you have one, you go to cycle two, that doubles it. Cycle three doubles that. Cycle four doubles that. You keep doubling until you get to 20 cycles. The patent shows that the correct use of that test stops at 20 cycles because it catches everything that's significant, and it's designed to find genetic sequences. It doesn't find diseases. It doesn't find anything else, and it finds genetic sequences at 20 cycles. So you have a test, a PCR test designed by a brilliant man who has the same opinion of Anthony Fauci as I do, which is that Anthony Fauci is not a scientist. Hasn't published any significant literature in his life that I'm aware of. Hasn't made a major contribution to the field as far as I'm aware of. And has this great bureaucratic position where he wields a tremendous amount of power. Now, one of the things about the emergency use authorization documents that were released in October of 2020 is that it requires four criteria to have emergency use authorization powers. And the last one being critical is that there are no treatments that are available. And so if there's no treatments, you have a right to have an emergency use. So it's important for the people in the government controlling this to say there are no safe and effective treatments. And I think you probably, you referred to Fleming method. I have a patented method that measures tissue change that can define the severity of what's going on in the body. And because the drugs work as rapidly as they do, can retest every 72 hours to see if treatment is effective. And that's what we did outside of the United States to find successful treatments for COVID-19, the disease, and also successful treatments for the infectious process, SARS-CoV-2. So there are successful treatments, but if you can put a lid on it and basically simply say there are no successful treatments because we say there are no successful treatments, we being the federal government, now you have emergency use authorization powers. And the PCR test was misapplied under emergency, it's being used as an emergency use authorization test. Not stopping at 20 cycles. Adding insult to injury of a man who dies from pneumonia with no known prior health problems, they use his test and prostitute his test by using it wrong. Driving it up, I mean, you know, you do the math, it's unfounded scientifically to be running 35 plus 45 cycles to do things. I mean, why are the cases of SARS-CoV-2 going down? I would argue it's because they've cut back on the number of cycles of PCR. I mean, you don't have to change anything. If you cut down the number of cycles, you're going to see fewer cases. Voila, you know, get your magic wand out or your vaccine out and wave it and you've got a cure, right? If you read the emergency use authorization documents of these drug vaccines and you do the math and you don't use the numbers like vaccine efficacy, which is based upon how many people end up being diagnosed with COVID, which is nothing more than having a PCR test that's positive and then having viral symptoms, which doesn't really mean it's SARS-CoV-2. But you really ask the question that Americans think is being asked, which is, let's compare how many people are diagnosed with COVID vaccinated versus non-vaccinated, and you do the statistical analysis, what you will discover is that there is no difference in the number of people who get diagnosed with COVID, whether they get vaccinated or not. Anybody who has any validity to be part of the conversation about drug vaccines will tell you that vaccines do not prevent infection. They never have, they never will. They are designed to expose you to what we think the infectious agent will be so that your body develops an immunity. And it's not a matter of keeping antibodies in your bloodstream, because if you had antibodies in your bloodstream for everything that you'd been exposed to, your blood would be so thick it wouldn't flow and your body would be wasting time and resources making all these antibodies that aren't needed. What's critical are the memory cells that are made that are sitting in your lymph nodes so that when you get exposed to something, your memory cells, cells that have memory of having been exposed before, are rapid to gear up either the T cells, which are the first part of your immune system that basically release chemicals to kill the virus and cells that are infected with the virus and to form blood clots to prevent nutrients from getting to the cells so that the cells infected with the virus can't thrive. Or later on, a few days, you know, about a week later, the antibodies to do the same thing, but from a different approach, and this time instead of attacking the cells, to attack the virus outside of the cells and to do the same types of chemical injury and blood clotting injury. So it's the memory cells that tell you whether you've got a response, and that's what you need. It's not the antibodies floating around or cytokine chemicals floating around or blood clots floating through people's bodies. So if you look at the emergency use authorization documents themselves, and I'm just astounded, nobody else seems to be doing this, and you do the mathematical statistical comparisons, there's no difference. There's no difference in the number of people who get COVID. There's no difference in the number of people who die with COVID. What there is a difference in the number of people who have side effects from the vaccines because they have inflammatory and thrombotic consequences. And you know, the numbers are just astronomical. And you know, to me, as a scientist physician, I'm just dumbfounded by the fact that, you know, more people are not seeing this. I think more people are becoming aware of it. But it bothers me that my medical colleagues have not caught on to this. I get it. You know, everybody was put into a shutdown mode. Everybody was put into a government control mode. You know, doctors who did step outside, their livelihoods were threatened, their licenses were threatened, their reputations were threatened, they were trashed in the media. You've got all sorts of people on social media who don't know what they're talking about, pretending that they're now scientific experts and attacking anybody who raises questions that, about this virus, about the treatment of the viruses, about the vaccines. You know, the thing that I am challenged to wrap my brain around is that at some point in time, do you not cognitively recognize that if what the other people like myself are telling you is true, that this might somehow hit home and have an impact on somebody that you love and care about? And you really do want the truth out there if that happens to you. And unfortunately, that's frequently what is required, is that somebody is personally affected and harmed for them to actually say, you know, maybe we need to take a serious look at this and really, you know, where the virus came from. And, you know, when you realize that the people who paid for the development of this bioweapon are the same people that have been involved in preventing the treatments from going out, are the same people that have been involved in developing the vaccines, and are the same people who have been working with CRISPR and other technologies behind the scenes. When you, if you just are the general person using common sense, if you listen to all that, it starts to unravel. If you listen to the whole thing, that shedding doesn't occur. You know, one of the reasons why I presented the way I did at Event 2021 was to point out that, look, okay, everybody's excited about the fact that a new paper got published that shows, oh wow, wait a minute, this spike proteins are found in the bloodstream within hours. Yeah, Moderna published a paper in 2017 using lipid nanoparticle mRNA vaccines for influenza virus. In 2017, they published a paper showing that in the animal models, which we decided not to use for SARS-CoV-2, in the animal models, they found the lipid nanoparticles in the brain, in the spleen, in the hearts, in the bone marrows, and in the muscles where it was injected. They found it all throughout the animals. This isn't a surprise. When they talk about shedding not being a real thing, well, there's self-amplifying mRNA and transmissible and vaccines that have been worked on for decades. And if you look at the self-amplifying mRNA documents, which, you know, I told people back in March of this year that it was impossible that these vaccines contained only the mRNA of the spike protein, because that doesn't produce enough spike protein to get this massive immune response. What a self-amplifying mRNA vaccine is a vaccine that has the mRNA of the antigen, in this case, the spike protein, plus it contains what's necessary in the first part of the genetic sequence, which is what's in open reading frame 1A and 1B, which is the replicase enzyme, which replicates the spike protein. And when you have that, you have a self-amplifying mRNA. And what's fascinating is that if you read the papers that have been published on this, you will see that this has been going on for the better part of decades. And they've done it for lots of viruses like HIV and rabies and others. And when you look at the animal models, you'll see dogs and pigs and mice and rats. But when you look under SARS-CoV-2, human is the animal
model. That's serious. I want to go into some other areas. And if you would please, because time is limited, we only have about eight minutes left.
Okay.
Could you give us short answers? Could you tell us what happens or can happen now that we know that it's not just going to stay stationary in the deltoid muscle, the arm, but it can spread throughout the body? And now we're seeing all these other conditions that first they tried to deny their association. What would be the worst case scenario that is still plausible based upon what we've seen up to this moment for people who have received the vaccines?
Right. So the interesting thing is that this virus and the spike protein is very exquisite at crossing the blood-brain barrier. We know that there's a prion-like domain on this spike protein that's a result of all these other inserts that happen. And we know from the animal models that there are brain diseases like spongiform encephalopathy, which is generally who is mad cow disease. We know that there are Lewy bodies that produce things like Alzheimer's diseases. And we know that the animal models presented this in short order. The humanized mice studies that were done, 95% of the mice died in 2 weeks, which is a year and a half in human terms. The rhesus macaque models, the animals were sacrificed at 5 to 6 weeks, and they showed the Alzheimer's, Lewy bodies and other neurodegenerative changes. We know that it damages the heart with inflammation. We know that it causes blood clots throughout the body. So we're just at the tip of the iceberg of these long-term sequelae. And the fact that they've gotten people to voluntarily inject themselves with these bioweapons is producing more changes. And one thing for your viewers to know and for you to know that I know we haven't I haven't really talked about yet with people, is that I've seen now the genetic code sequences for the SARS-CoV-2 virus and the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. And where the protein for the spike protein looks very similar compared to the naturally, well, it's not naturally occurring, compared to the man-made SARS-CoV-2 virus, I will tell you that the genome of the Pfizer vaccine and the Moderna vaccine do not match the SARS-CoV-2 virus. They are both different from each other. They are both genetically different from the virus. So the vaccines themselves are introducing something into people that aren't even the spike protein of the SARS-CoV man-made bioweapon. And the unfortunate thing about that is that it means, as far as I'm concerned, there's a great potential that this represents a perpetuating problem for people. I've sometimes referred to it as the potential for SARS-CoV-3 and 4, which sets up a scenario for where you're going to need to keep vaccinating, which allows further changes to be done, a vicious cycle that has been initiated. And that is, you know, clearly, I think, one of the reasons behind this push and shove and threat that we are going to vaccinate everybody, whether they darn well like it or not. And with the successful shedding process, you don't even have to vaccinate everybody to get it to transmit. And anybody who says shedding doesn't exist is not only ignoring the published research, but the document I showed at Event 2021, written by the FDA and Health and Human Services, published in August of 2015 as a guide to the industry to tell the big pharma what to do to deal with shedding for viral and bacterial mRNA gene therapies.
We have time for one last answer. And then I'm going to have to invite you back for another hour because I still have a lot of questions. I read a scientific paper. I saw the person who was the head of that lead author, and it was from an Australian television investigative journalist that showed that the top scientist within the defense establishment of China was discussing how the gain-of-function research using the SARS virus was specifically to be used as a biological weapon. This was several years before 2019 and the event of SARS getting into the public. So are you familiar with that person? Are you familiar with the two scientists who are under investigation who came from Wuhan to an Ottawa top research and SARS research center and virus research center using bat viruses, then taking that information and being challenged as spies, taking it back to China and then going back to the Wuhan lab? These are actually interconnected. And real quick, if you can get in there, what proof do you have that this was intentionally released through a wet market rather than accidentally released by people working at the lab?
Right. So I don't know those researchers personally, which is how I answer those questions. I've heard the reports of that. I've also heard and know that the Chinese military had documents in the 1990s designed to address the issue of how to attack the United States and other countries, and it was through this type of viral bioweapon technology. The personal contact I have is Dr. Li Min Yang, or Yan rather, sorry. And Dr. Yan is in hiding currently. She was a virologist in Hong Kong, and her supervisors had firsthand personal knowledge of SARS-CoV-1, the original bioweapon. And she has knowledge that this SARS-CoV-2 was intentionally taken and released at the wet market with the purpose of making it look like it was a naturally occurring phenomenon to test it out. And Dr. Yan is very knowledgeable and very brave for having come forward. She and I have done a couple programs together matching up our knowledge base, which fits perfectly, unfortunately.
We're out of time. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Fleming.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Gary Noll. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, there's far too many of you dying.